At this point in time, Karen Conti is on the radio. Hey, Karen, how are you?
Steve, happy holidays to you.
Well, you know how I say it. Happy holidays.
Oh.
Of course. And Karen, you know, for these questions that I have, I'm kind of filling in for you here, but I would have thought, okay, Karen Conti from Conti Legal, blah, 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 blah. She's the one, the WGN Legal Eagle, who would be perfect to answer these questions anyway. So I don't know if you heard the previous conversation, and a part of it was on stop and frisk, which I thought wasn't really a legal idea, a legal thing to do, but a caller, Pete, said, yeah, this is what we need in Chicago. And we've had several texts come in saying, no, this one text saying it's been ruled by the courts to be unconstitutional. Another said the same thing, actually. So what do you say?
Well, you have to go back to the Constitution, because that's where we go for all of these types of things. And the Fourth Amendment says that you cannot be unreasonably searched and seized. Okay, so we go back and we say, what does that mean? And over the years, all of the cases that have been decided result in what we call precedent, which means what can the police do and what can't they do? And the only way that they can stop you is if they have reasonable belief that you have either committed a crime or that you have information leading to the arrest of somebody who has committed a crime. So the typical case is you're standing on a street corner and you're looking suspicious, and it looks like you just robbed a jewelry store because you have necklaces around your neck.
Or you have a mask on, right?
Well, that's another problem, right? The police have a reasonable belief, a probable cause to stop you. And at that point, what can they do? They can pat you down. They can frisk you. And the purpose is either to find evidence that the crime was committed and you committed it, or they want to protect themselves. So the other part they can do is to pat you down to make sure that you don't have a weapon that could be used against the police officer when the police officer is making the stop. And that's another situation, too, in a car. If you have a taillight out, there's a probable cause to stop you because you have violated a technical rule, and the police can stop you. And at that point, they can look around. If they see something that looks like a gun or drugs, then at that point, they can frisk you. They can have you step out of the car, and they can look in the open spaces to see if there is evidence of a crime. So it's limited, but it does leave the police quite a bit of discretion.
But what if I am just standing on the corner wearing a mask, and for some reason, and if I'm African-American, it's not for some reason. I would argue, let's be real, that's going to happen more often. Or if I'm a person of color in general. And if I'm standing on a street corner and the police want to stop and frisk me, I'm already stopped, I'm just standing there, can I say, no, you can't touch me, tell me what the probable cause is?
Yeah, sure you can say that. And I always tell people, you know, you have rights, and the rights are very important, but I would never argue with a police officer. You know, they have a very tough job to do.
Yes.
They are under
yes.
a lot of stress, especially now as your past listener, caller, was talking about. It's a terrible time to be a police officer. I have many friends and clients who are. So you can say that politely, sir, can you tell me what the probable cause is to stop me? And you know, but again, if the police officer says, I need to frisk you right now, you're not going to put up a fight, because then that's a separate crime, right? That's going to be resisting arrest. But certainly you have a right to ask that question. And do police officers make mistakes and overstep their bounds when it comes to this? Yes, they do. But that's on the other end of it. That's a lawsuit that you might bring. I always say, you know, take one thing at a time, respect the police officer, do what he asks you to do, ask the questions politely, and then hopefully you'll move on with your life and move forward. But, you know, your point is well taken about people being of color, and the ACLU did a study in New York when they were doing all of that stop and frisk, and the results of that study showed that 9 out of 10 New Yorkers who were stopped and frisked were actually innocent and there was no evidence of a crime. So, you know, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I think that, you know, we really need to examine that if we're going to be stopping people willy-nilly for no good reason. I'm just not a fan of that.
Well, and I think in New York, everything you said is absolutely, I've read the same thing, and crime went down. But what the study, as I remember, did not indicate is that there's any correlation there for sure, Or does here's my question. Does correlation mean causation? So
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's your view on that?
My view on that is from the studies I've seen, and there really isn't a correlation. It's one of those feel-good things. People say, yeah, you know what, I don't mind. I don't mind if you frisk me. I don't mind if you stop me because I have nothing to hide. But I have to tell you, I do this little speech when I talk to my students in law school, and people say that, and then I walk up to one of my students, and I start grabbing her purse, and I start looking inside of it, and the woman invariably pulls the purse to her going, what are you doing? Well, that's what we're talking about, invading your privacy. And if police start doing that with people, it's not going to be well received. It just isn't. And it could result in more disrespect for the police. It can result in more violence in that, you know, people don't like it and they strike back. They shouldn't do it, but they might. I'm just not a big fan of that. Certainly, if someone looks like they committed a crime and there's reasonable cause, absolutely, that constitution allows it.
Karen, I have a question here from a texter who wants to know if you can sue me for all the bad jokes I've told today.
Oh, I think that would be intentional infliction of emotional distress. but I would defend you on that, Steve, because I would say that you're making a valiant attempt to make people laugh in this very depressing time that we're going through, and that would be a full defense to any lawsuit.
All right. This explains why I love Karen Conti. I want to talk about those tinted windows we've been talking about. And also, can you say, I got COVID at work, I want to sue you, or sue the store you happen to shop at, the legalities of all of that, when we come back on WGN. It is 3:48 on WGN. Steve Dale, Steve Dale's Other World, or an extension of my show, kind of into Karen Conti's show. Karen Conti, the voice of legal issues. That's my title for her anyway, on WGN Radio. And this is kind of fun, Karen, because for the first time that I remember ever, I'm interviewing you. It's usually you talking to me about some sort of pet-related thing going on that has to do with legal something or another. This time, the something or another, and it's a great point, and lots of text on this issue brought up by listener Pete, who wondered about the tinted windows. And I will tell you, I thought they are illegal in Chicago, but like lots of people who texted, I see them all the time. So are they legal? Are they not legal? Are they legal with caveats? How does that work?
Yeah, every state has a special law when it comes to tinting windows, and there's actually a website that talks about that. Although, you know, if you go get your windows tinted, they'll tell you that there's rules, like you can, it has to be only the top six, the top 6 inches of your front and your sides, and it has to allow 35% of the sun in, and all, there's all kinds of rules. And but obviously, if you're going to a place that's reputable, you're going to ask them to comply with the law in that particular state. And there's good reason for it. And I think I remember this correctly. A friend of yours and mine, Judy Barth the Pinka,
was the one who
initiated the legislation in Illinois many years back when she was, I believe, a state senator. And the idea is that police officers obviously don't want to walk up to a car where they can't see in, and it poses a huge danger to them. So that's the reason that we have these laws and that people should comply with them. I mean, there's certain percentages, and you have to comply with it. And now when you go out of state, I think they allow you, if you have different laws in different states, they allow you to get by. It's not like you have to change your tinting every time you go to a different state. So they're fairly reasonable laws.
Yeah, reasonable, but I'm not sure that they're enforced in Chicago anyway, because I see them all the time.
Yeah, I once was in an Uber where I was stopped, and because they did have, it was too dark, and they had a little machine where they were like, you know, they could put up on the window and they could tell that it was too dark. So I did have that. I did see that in effect. But I think now in Chicago, we have way too many things to worry about, like carjackings and murders and all kinds of other things to worry about that.
Well, that's true. I don't know. Have you ever worked with the many, 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 many things you've done? Have you ever worked on legislation actually written or crafted, or have been a part of advocating for specific legislation?
I have. I was asked to work on the legislation that changed the divorce laws in Illinois about 8 years ago. It was about 8 years ago, and we got rid of grounds, which made it easier to, for people to get divorced once they had decided to get divorced. We changed the laws of child support to take into account both parties' incomes rather than just the payers, and a bunch of other things. And it was a complete overhaul of the law, which was well needed, and I was part of that. I mean, I was one of several, many, you know, judges and lawyers who weighed in on that. And yes, I have worked on it. And that my claim to fame was that I helped write that no-fault divorce law in Illinois.
Well, yes, and I know that's your wheelhouse. The reason why I ask the question, as you know, I've been involved many, many, many times, and with animal welfare sorts of laws and ordinances. And what strikes me is how many times I've begun working on something, and then I realize along the way, if this were to pass, it's not going to be enforced anyway. Is that something that is a frustration to you or something you think about at all? I mean, you've got all these laws on the books, some laws people don't even know about, and they don't know about them. If they don't know about them, it can't be enforced, for starters. But above and beyond, I'm talking about law enforcement not knowing about them. I'm talking about people who do what you do, the attorneys, not even knowing about some of these laws.
You know, I don't, if I were a professional law drafter, I wouldn't necessarily, I'd be concerned about that, but it wouldn't stop me from drafting the law. And here's why. I think that we have to have laws. And, you know, the prosecutors have great discretion, and so do the police, and who they stop and who they prosecute and who they plea bargain and who they sentence to jail. So there's a lot of discretion there. But if we have the laws on the books, there's the hope, at least, that people are going to comply with it. And if there's an egregious case of a violation, that would give the tools to law enforcement to take that person and prosecute them and use them as an example. And that's somehow sometimes the best advertisement for a new law is when someone gets accused of something and violated and goes to jail or spends some time doing probation or whatever. And that sends the message to other people that this is not to be tolerated in our society, whatever it is, whether it's, you know, something to do with children, having to do with animals, having to do with tinted windows. I think it's important to have laws on the books that make sense.
So we were talking about the responsibility of the employer or the store. How far does it go? So if I go into a store and I get sick in a week, I don't know how to prove that I got COVID-19 at your store, but nevertheless, there are here and there, there's a concern. I don't think this concern is also matching up from what I understand to the real world, because I don't think what I'm about to say is really happening very often, or a concern that at the workplace that I could then go ahead, turn around and sue my employer for the fact that I got COVID-19. So where are we with that?
You're absolutely right that people in business and employers are concerned about it. But as a practical matter, you would have to prove that the employer, that first of all, that you got it there. You're absolutely right. How in the world do you prove that you got it at your workplace and not on the bus or not at your kid's daycare or not at your, you know, from your husband or walking down the street? I mean, we can't tell that. And it's not like you can just file a lawsuit and say, I think I got it there. You have to have some causation, some proof. So that's number one. And number two, even if you could prove you got it at the workplace or at your hair salon, then if the hair salon is taking all precautions that are appropriate, like social distancing, having you take your temperature, wearing masks, doing hand sanitizer, then they've done everything they can. And even if you got it there, they're not negligent. So you would lose that lawsuit. There's another layer, the waivers. So some of these places have waivers where you waive your rights to sue. And finally, in 19 states, there are laws that say, at least temporarily, you cannot sue a business for COVID. They want to give businesses a break. So so there's three or four layers of the protection here.
So why are the legislators, I'm talking about the members of Congress, making at least some of them so much of a big deal out of this? Do you think it's being overplayed?
They are. No, you're absolutely right, because this part of this package that they're supposedly passed now, I haven't read the latest version, but the piece that they were fighting about, or one of the pieces, when I'm fighting about everything, was whether we should have a federal moratorium on lawsuits relating to COVID to get businesses back up on their feet and to stop people from suing or having the threat of a lawsuit. And I don't think it's that big a deal because of what I just told you, that all of those lawsuits would be so hard to bring anyway, and what's the harm in putting a moratorium on for 18 months. I think maybe some lawyers are being extra careful and saying, well, that will that make the businesses and the employers and the schools lax in some of their treatment of how customers are required to do certain things. And so as a practical matter, we're going to keep those lawsuits out there because it keeps employers and businesses in line. I'm not sure I'm a fan of that way of thinking.
Well, I am a fan of Karen Conti. You are a terrific guest, of course. I thank you very much for joining me on your show.
What well, and thank say? You, thank you for graciously being a host. And I have a quick joke for you. Right?
Yes, yes.
I heard your dumb joke.
Go. No, they're not dumb. What did she say? Go ahead.
Why is Eggs Benedict best served on a hubcap?
Why is Eggs Benedict best served on a hubcap?
Because there's no place like Chrome for the Hollandaise.
That's dumb.